All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Wednesday, February 25th. We're almost done with the cellular respiration chapter, and we're going to move on to nervous system, or at least an introduction to nervous system today. And I don't know if I have anything important to say, except that there was a test scheduled sometime coming up, and probably won't be next week. Okay, did we talk about that last time? Yeah, okay, good. So here's a sign-in sheet for today. Go ahead, sign that, pass it around. And, okay, so there are different ways that you can look at cellular respiration, but the first way is to know what is the purpose of cellular respiration? Yeah, to make ATP, right? To harness energy, to get energy in the form of chemical energy in the form of ATP. So you have to couple exergonic reactions with the formation of ATP, which is endergonic, and all of the reactions that you see right here, namely glycolysis and the preparatory reaction, the Krebs cycle, electron transport, are all exergonic metabolic pathways. And through evolution, biology has figured out how to harness that energy and use it to make ATP. So there are two ways that you can make ATP. What are the two ways that evolution has figured out how to make ATP via these exergonic reactions? Okay, different ways that you can talk about it. Aerobic respiration versus anaerobic respiration is one way you could talk about it. What's another way you could talk about it? How about substrate level phosphorylation versus oxidative phosphorylation? That's another way you could talk about it. They're not synonymous. They actually involve other and different kinds of pathways. So let's review these different pathways. Aerobic respiration, let's start with anaerobic respiration. Anaerobic respiration starts with what? Glucose. Okay, glucose gets converted to pyruvic acid via glycolysis, and then under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid gets converted to lactic acid. And how many ATPs are produced by this anaerobic respiratory pathway? Just two, yeah, just a measly two. All right? And you should know where that takes place in the cell and these metabolic pathways and reactions. All right, here's the beginning and here's the end point. Aerobic respiration, on the other hand, what molecule do you start with? What molecule? What's the energy molecule you start with? Glucose. Yeah, it's the same molecule as for anaerobic respiration. It's the same molecule. And there's a common pathway, namely glucose going to pyruvic acid, which is glycolysis, right? So glycolysis is a common pathway to anaerobic respiration as well as aerobic respiration. All right, but if it's under aerobic conditions, pyruvic acid goes into the Krebs cycle through electron transport all the way to CO2 and water. So aerobic respiration is what? Glucose going to CO2 and water and producing about how many ATP?
About
30-something, right, depending on what kind of detail you want to get into. All right, so that just compares anaerobic with aerobic. These are the endpoints right here and the production of ATP. Now, what about that substrate level? Where does substrate level phosphorylation take place? That takes place partly in glycolysis. Everywhere but electron transport, which is glycolysis, and also one for every turn of the Krebs cycle. All right, so again, that is part of the anaerobic pathway as well as aerobic pathway for glycolysis, and Krebs cycle only happens under aerobic conditions, right? Now, what's the other kind of way that you can make ATP besides substrate level phosphorylation?
Oxidative
phosphorylation. And does that happen in glycolysis?
No.
What about the prep reaction?
No.
What about Krebs cycle?
No.
Well, we're running out of options here. Okay, which means what? It has to happen electron transport, right? That's electron transport. So don't forget that glycolysis is a common pathway between anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration, and where substrate level phosphorylation takes place and oxidative phosphorylation, where that takes place. Know then parts of the cell that those pathways exist, where they exist, right? Either in the cytosol or inside mitochondria. All right, and then the other thing that is pretty amazing is you got to become a little bit familiar with the chemiasmotic theory, which is, what does the chemiasmotic theory tell us? It explains, what does the chemiasmotic theory explain? What does it explain? Where does it take place?
In the mitochondria.
Okay. What's the job of the mitochondria? To make ATP, right? To make ATP, right? So the chemiasmotic theory tells you what? It explains how ATP is made by mitochondria, right? By those high energy electrons. So what's the direct source of energy for making ATP via oxidative phosphorylation? The hydrogen gradient across the Christi membrane, or the inner mitochondrial membrane, because hydrogens have to flow through this ATP synthase, or you could call it ATP synthetase, it goes by different names, and as hydrogens flow from high concentration to low, that extra energy can be used to phosphorylate ADP. Right? So that's the chemiasmotic theory. But how do you get this high hydrogen ion concentration in the intermembrane space? They're pumped up there via what kind of energy source? The flow of electrons through the electron transport chain, and in order for that to happen, you have to have oxygen as a final acceptor of those electrons. Otherwise, it won't happen. Okay, so that's the chemiasmotic theory. So these little guys right here, the ATP synthases, they're a pretty big protein complex that you can actually see with the electron microscopy, and they kind of look like a lollipop or a mushroom or something sticking off the membrane. Okay, you might even have a question in the back of the book about that. All right, so that is...
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the chemiasmotic theory is just a part of the electron transport chain.
Yeah, the chemiasmotic theory explains how this electron transport chain actually gets... How can it convert energy from those electrons into energy that ends up in ATP? Which is kind of amazing. I don't know if I were to sit down and design something, how I would go about doing that. So yeah, the mitochondria do that via what this chemiasmotic theory. Using these pumps driven by the flow of electrons, the proton pumps driven by the flow of electrons, and then as these protons flow back down into the matrix, the ATP synthase does the job of making ATP. Okay. And that only happens under what kind of conditions? Under aerobic conditions, because you need that oxygen there to accept those electrons. Okay. I think there's only one last thing in this chapter that we really have time to talk about. Oh, but I do have something else to say, and that is, you know, because of electron transport, that NADH and FADH2 can be used to make ATP, because they donate electrons via oxidation reduction reactions to electron transport. And in this class, what are you going to use as the conversion factor for every NADH? How many can electron ETC make?
Three.
It's always going to be 3. And for FADH2, it's always going to be 2. Right? So some of the answers that you have on the web use some other more esoteric numbers like 2.5 or 1.5 or whatever. But in here, it's just always going to be 3 and 2. Right? That's the theoretical maximum. All right. So this table right here is just slightly misleading, but we wrote our own table on the board, right? And you can calculate that. Okay. So we're going to use those same conversion factors when we look into other energy sources. And another important energy source are lipids that are inside your body. And a lipid would be something like a triglyceride is a pretty good example of a lipid. So what are the building blocks of a triglyceride?
Glycerol.
And 3 fatty acids, and glycerol is very much like a carbohydrate molecule. It's kind of somewhere between an alcohol and a carbohydrate. All right, it's a 3-carbon fragment, so it can interact with glycolysis very easily, and it can be used to run glycolysis in the reverse direction to make what?
Glycogen.
To make, yeah, but before you get to glycogen, what do you make first? You make, yeah, glucose first, and then it can be converted into glycogen. All right, so don't forget, you just need 2 molecules of glycerol to do that. What do you call that chemical pathway of going from glycerol to glucose? Gluconeogenesis. What do you call that pathway going from glucose to glycogen? That is? glycogenesis. So you can, maybe tonight you should just write all those four words down like 10 times, say it out loud. They're kind of tongue twisters, they're kind of mind twisters. So look at what? Glycogenolysis, glycogenesis, glycolysis, and gluconeogenesis. And if you need a graphical way to think about it, go ahead and draw it out on a piece of paper as well, and then jot those words down, spell them out, and even pronounce them. Maybe in the car when you're by yourself so people don't think you're totally nuts. Okay. All right, so here you have fat. It's an energy source, can be used as an energy source. Okay. So glycerol, one glycerol can be used for one turn of the Krebs cycle, right? So it would be worth about half the energy of a glucose once you get down into the Krebs cycle. But the other elements you have are the fatty acids. These are long hydrocarbon chains, and they might have 16 carbon units or 18 carbon units or maybe 20 carbons in a fatty acid. And on one end of the fatty acid, because we call it an acid, has what kind of group? It has a carboxyl functional group, right? And it can be metabolized from that end into two carbon fragments. And a two carbon fragment is what we call an acetyl group. And if it's not bound to anything, it could be an acid too. If it's just an acid, what would we call that acid? If it just has a carboxyl group on the end. Two carbon with a carboxyl group on one end is an acetic acid. Okay, so acetyl and acetic acid are related kinds of terms. All right, that's a two carbon fragment. Now, can this acetyl group right here be used to make glucose? Okay, maybe we did go over that because the conversion between pyruvic acid and acetyl-CoA is a one-way street, right? So these fatty acids right here can never be used to make glucose. So the fate of fatty acids is either to be used for energy via the Krebs cycle here in electron transport, or fatty acids can be used to make, triglycerides. That's the only possible fate for lipids. Once you eat a lipid, that's all you can do with it. Store it or burn it up, right? Unless you play some tricks with your metabolism like via the Atkins diet or something. But that's pretty wild kind of treatment for your body. All right, so how do these fatty acids get into the form of acetyl-CoA? You're familiar with what can happen to acetyl-CoA, how it generates energy. But this step right here, you're not so educated on yet. All right, so the process of going from a fat to its building blocks is called lipolysis, right? That's lipolysis. The reverse is what? Lipogenesis. And I think in the web questions, they actually have that wrong. All right, so make sure you know breaking a triglyceride down into its building blocks is lipolysis. But taking a fatty acid and converting it into acetyl-CoA, all right, that's not lipolysis. That's called beta oxidation. And the other thing that you should know about is where in the cell does beta oxidation take place? And that happens inside mitochondria, right? So beta oxidation takes place in mitochondria, and that is the exergonic reaction that your body uses to make a lot of ATP. Okay, so I don't even think I'm going to have time to talk about that slide. All right, so fatty acids and glycerol is lipogenesis. The reverse process is lipolysis. And you're probably familiar with everything else that's on this slide. Lipolysis, you need a lipase to break things down. Okay, so here is the last slide that I'm going to show you in this chapter, and this is beta oxidation. Okay, so beta oxidation does what? Just generally speaking, what does it do? It's going to break something down. It's going to, metabolize. It's going to break fatty acids down, which is a big molecule, into smaller molecules. And so that's an exergonic reaction. It can be coupled to the synthesis of ATP. All right, so here is a long chain fatty acid. So here is a carboxyl group. Here's an alpha carbon, beta carbon. All right, and you can just count the carbons down. To get beta oxidation started, you need to spend an ATP. Just like what other kind of reaction? Like glycolysis. To get glucose going through glycolysis, you have to spend a little bit to get this reaction going. All right, but through these different steps of beta oxidation, and you don't really have to understand the organic chemistry right here, but you should just know some of the endpoints of what's happening. Okay, through beta oxidation, you end up losing two carbons off of the fatty acid. It gets broken off, and it gets then bound to coenzyme A, so that makes an acetyl coenzyme A. So if you start with a 16-carbon fatty acid, how many do you end up with at this point right here? You end up with a 14-carbon, okay? And then what? You got a 12-carbon after that, because this is a nice cycle. It's broken down two carbon units at a time. Right, then 12, then what, 10, then 8, all right? So if it's an 18-carbon fatty acid, how many rounds of beta oxidation does it have to go through? What's 18? 18 divided by 2, okay, is 9. Is that right? Is that right? It actually goes through, oh yeah, but it's only, you know what, 8 times. Because the last time you break it into what, 2 carbon fragments. All right, so it's one less than half of the number of carbons in a fatty acid. Okay. Alright, so through beta oxidation, you get an FADH2, which produces how many ATP? Because they donate these electrons to ETC. You get 2, and it also generates an NADH, which you get 3, right, ATPs from. So you should just multiply the number of rounds to completely beta oxidize a fatty acid times, alright, 1 FAD and 1 NADH, and you can calculate how many ATPs for every round of beta oxidation. So it's not too terribly complicated. But don't forget that very first time you got to subtract off an ATP. But that's only for the first step, right? That's not for subsequent steps. All right, so it's not too terribly hard to figure out how many ATPs are produced by beta oxidation. And the only other thing you have to know is where that takes place. And under what kind of conditions does it take place? It happens in mitochondria. Under what kind of conditions? Aerobic conditions, because it requires the Krebs cycle and, of course, electron transport. Okay. All right, so you know what? I think that's all I'm going to say about this chapter. So we're not going to talk about amino acid metabolism and all that kind of stuff. But I think if you read the chapter, if you're interested, it's not too terribly difficult to understand some of that metabolism. It won't be on the test, but you might be interested in just reading that part of the chapter anyway. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And then two again, two again, two again. Okay. The big difference in your mind for the test, make sure you know the difference between lipolysis and beta oxidation. They're not the same. Okay.
So lipolysis is like hydrolysis, right?
Yeah. Lipolysis is just a very simple hydrolysis reaction.
Breaking down fat to use.
Breaking down triglyceride into glycerol and 3 fatty acids. Yeah. And that doesn't require oxygen for that to happen. I tell you what, maybe if we got some time right after class, I'll draw it on the board. Okay.
Beta oxidation, does that only occur with fatty acids?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. An acetyl CoA. Okay. Let's maybe see. Let's see. I'll give myself 2 minutes. After 2 minutes, I got to stop talking. Okay. So you got an acetyl-CoA, all right? Acetyl-CoA. So that goes directly into the Krebs cycle, all right? So what does Krebs give us? Oops. Krebs gives us 3 NADH. Well, I hope I get close to 10. Okay, I get 3 NADHs. And we get what else? 1 FADH2 and... 1 ATP right here. Okay. Now I use different numbers than what's in the book. Let's work it out with my numbers first and see. Okay. So that's Krebs cycle. It's inside the mitochondria. You don't have to worry about a preparatory reaction or anything. It's already taken care of for us. So what do we got? 3 times? 3? 3 ATPs for every NADH? Okay, so far. Then 1 FADH2 times? 2, all right, and of course that's just 1 over here. So What do we got? We got, that's not going to add up to 10 at all, is it? All right, so here is, that's 2, and here's 1. So I have 13.
Well, they did 1.5.
12. So where are these two missing from?
Oh, it's glycerol. I'm glad.
Okay, but see, they're not using this and this. They're using what? 2.5 and 1.5. All right, so that's 1.5 here. And then there's a half here. 1.5 plus a half is 2. So if I have 12 minus 2, that's 10. So they're just using a different conversion factor. Right? So it actually makes sense to me. Does that sort of make sense to you? Yeah. Well, because glucose, all right, don't forget glucose, the pyruvate enters the mitochondria, but there's a preparatory reaction. And so for every glucose, you get 2 more NADHs. And by my calculation, that would be an extra 6 ATP. Okay? Okay. So, yeah, we didn't get too confused with that. Yeah. So just be aware that your book uses 2.5 and 1.5, but let's just use 3 and 2. Yeah.
So if you give us a problem on the test.
3 and 2. Okay. 3 and 2, no stray marks on your Scantron. Okay? Okay. All right, next chapter. pretty fascinating next chapter right here. Now, I did put the study guide for this chapter online, and I'm sure over the weekend I'll get all the rest of the study guides, but I have an additional figure to put online for this particular chapter. All right, and that's just a hand-drawn figure that a previous student drew, and it helped you understand how a neuron functions. So I'll put that online as well over the weekend. And I don't even have a picture to show you of it right at the moment, unless it happens to be an important figure for us to look at. 241. Oh, you know what? I bet I don't have it. Because I had to switch classrooms. That's right. This is a different classroom. Okay, so maybe ask me another question because I have to keep talking, otherwise my microphone is going to turn off. And then I'm not going to have this recorded. Where do I have to go? Someplace that looks like Blackboard. Where's Blackboard at? Ah, here we go. Now, does it know who I am? Is this close to you guys? Maybe? Oh, does this look familiar? Yeah. Documents, that's your PowerPoint slides, and?
Seven.
Thank you so much. Well, it says it's there. Oops. Okay, nervous system. Well, this is the first part of this chapter is going to be really easy because it's just a review from anatomy, and I probably shouldn't even say much about it. But it might be, who knows, maybe even a couple years since you took anatomy, so I'll just say a little bit about it anyway, okay, just to help you remember some things. So we're going to talk about the structure of the nervous system, all right, the structure of neurons and glial cells or neuroglia. And then we're going to get back to some physiology, namely these membrane potentials. But I do want to talk about the function of some of the cells of the nervous system. All right, so don't forget that when you think of nervous system, it can be broken down into two major parts, the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And the central nervous system is made out of the brain and spinal cord. Peripheral nervous system is everything outside the brain and spinal cord, including cranial nerves and spinal nerves, right? Okay. There are two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue, right? Nervous tissue is a kind of tissue in the body. What are some other tissues that you have? There are four. Nervous tissue is one. Muscle is one kind. Connective tissue is another kind. And epithelium is another kind of tissue, right? So nervous tissue is one kind of tissue all by itself, and it can be broken down into neurons and supporting cells, which we call neuroglia or glial cells. Neurons are the functional units of the nervous system. They transmit electrical impulses, and we're going to see how it transmits those electrical impulses in this chapter. The glial cells just maintain the homeostasis of the nervous system, and for years and years and years, people were really not interested in glial cells because they don't conduct electrical impulses, and people thought that they pretty much were useless in the nervous system. But nowadays, we know that they might even be more important than neurons. They have a lot of important functions that we're going to talk about. All right, but nonetheless, we still consider neurons the functional units because they carry electrical impulses very quickly over long distances for controlling your body. And you have at least five times as many glial cells compared to neurons in your nervous system. All right, so let's first look at some neurons. They gather information and transmit information. Right, they can pick up stimuli, and they can then send that information via electrical chemical impulses to distant parts of your body. And when those impulses get to the part of the body that they're going to, they release some kind of signaling molecule. And that signaling molecule is, anybody know what the general name for that signaling molecule a neuron can release? Neurotransmitter, and maybe you even know some specific names. What's a good specific name of a neurotransmitter? Glutamate is one of them. That's not a common one. It's actually very common in your body, but in an educational sense, that's kind of a higher level kind of neurotransmitter. It's in the book. Very good, very good. Yeah, we'll talk about glutamate and some of these others. All right, but acetylcholine would be one that probably you have heard of before. All right, so neurons have a cell body. These are the main parts of a neuron. The cell body, or the soma right here, the dendrites, are these small projections, and an axon is this very long projection. And signals move along this neuron. And can you see an arrow? In what direction is that arrow pointing? Is it bidirection or one direction?
One direction?
It's one direction, and it always points from dendrite to cell body down an axon. That's how information is passed. All right? Electrical information isn't passed in the reverse direction. We see two different kinds of neurons right here. You should be able to recognize them by their structure. This one you should recognize as just being a standard multipolar kind of neuron. And you should know what its function is.
Motor.
It's motor. Yeah, it's a motor neuron. Okay. This one right here is a unipolar. And what is its function? Its opposite motor, it is sensory. Yeah, so this is a sensory. So another way of talking about this one is that it is an efferent neuron, and this is an afferent. I'm mispronouncing that a little bit because you should really say what, afferent. But it's hard, sometimes when there's an echo, sometimes it's hard to distinguish if somebody's saying efferent or afferent. So I say afferent. So I pretend I'm like from some place somewhere, like some place in the deep south, okay? Okay. The other thing that you see, not only neurons, but you also see some neuroglia cells here as well, all right? And these neuroglia cells or Schwann cells, we find these in the peripheral nervous system. This bipolar neuron right here, this process is what we call the peripheral process. This is what we call the central process. And so why would we call this the peripheral process? This is a peripheral process because this is the one that is in the periphery of your body. It's outside your central nervous system. And we call this the central process because where does it end up? It ends up in your central nervous system, so therefore it's the central process. So impulses always go from the peripheral process up through the central process. And I mention that because it doesn't look very centrally located, but we don't call it that because it's centrally located. What is located centrally in this neuron is the cell body, and where would you look for these cell bodies if you wanted to look? Right outside the spinal cord in what? The dorsal root ganglia. Right? So if there's going to be an accumulation of thousands of these nerve cell bodies in the dorsal root ganglia, and therefore we call it what? A ganglion. Because that's what we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system someplace. Okay. I think I talked about everything on this slide right here. These dendrites and cell body, they receive, this is the receiving end. These receive signals. That's the receiving end of the neuron because they have ligand-gated channels. A ligand is a small molecule that will bind to a larger protein. It's a receptor in the cell membrane, a ligand-gated receptor protein. And it's a channel because it can open up and it might allow ions to move from inside the cell to the outside. And those channels are not, they can be controlled. They can be opened and controlled depending on various activities around the cell. Axons, on the other hand, are what we call the sending part of the neuron. And it's different than the cell body and dendrite right here because they have different membrane proteins. They don't have ligand-gated channels, they have voltage-gated channels. So these channels open or close depending on the membrane potential or the voltage on a membrane. So they don't listen for chemical signals like the ligand-gated channels do. They just feel the voltage around them, and depending on the voltage, they undergo a conformation change which may open or close a ion channel. Okay, so we're going to talk about this, these different channels, probably for the next three lectures. All right, so you can't possibly really understand what I'm talking about yet, but I have to mention it now because that's something that you want to look forward to as I'm talking. And then once you learn about it, what do you got to do? You got to go back and look at this slide again and then work with the information and then what? Go back even two or three times before it makes sense. So this is an iterative process that we have to go through. All right, so if you don't follow with the first lecture, you have to keep coming back because eventually it will make sense. All right. Okay, so we're going to change the topic just a little bit. We're still on neurons, but we're going to talk about the flow down an axon. So this is just the flow of material, not electrical information, but just the flow of material. And it can happen in two different ways, either by axoplasmic flow or by axonal transport. So axoplasmic flow is when the fluid, the cytosol inside the axon, can actually get pushed down to an axon terminus where the terminal buttons are. I didn't mention that on any of the previous slides, but do you know where a terminal button is? What a terminal button? Should I go back and show you what a terminal button is? All right. A terminal button are these little swellings at the end of an axon. Sometimes we call that an axon terminus, or we might call it a bouton terminale or terminal button. And inside these terminal buttons, that's where the neurotransmitter is stored to be released. And so there's a little swelling. They're filled with synaptic vesicles, the terminal buttons. All right. So material has to flow down to those axon terminals. One way that it can do that, axoplasmic flow, because there is a rhythmic contraction of the axon. Kind of seems like peristalsis or something that maybe you can envision in your digestive tract, just squishing material down in that direction. But you can see that that's probably a pretty slow process. But for things that are in solution, compounds that are soluble, that's a good way for them to get down there. Other materials that are not soluble can't move by peristalsis, maybe even vesicles. Large vesicles don't move that way. They move down by axonal transport. So how would you move a chromosome around inside of a cell or a vesicle or some other organelle? Maybe you got a mitochondria over here on the left, but you need it on the left side of your cell. How's it going to move from one part of the cell to another? It's going to hop a ride on something. Okay, and you're right, it would be analogous to axonal transport right here, but how are these organelles or chromosomes, how are they going to get pushed and pulled around inside the cell? Okay, via the microtubules. Because how could you think of a microtubule system? What's a good way to think of a microtubule system? Okay, I like to think of it as, maybe I didn't mention this before, as a monorail. Okay, a monorail is just a single track, and you hang a train on it, and that train can go various places. So you got to go to Disneyland over the weekend and check out the monorail and say, oh, that's what a microtubule is, right? So these vesicles can hop a ride on a microtubule, and there are two different ways that a vesicle can hop a ride on a microtubule via axonal transport. Right, so a vesicle is large and insoluble. The direction is bidirectional. Something can move from the cell body down to an axon terminus, or stuff can move from an axon terminus back up into the cell body. So going from the cell body down to an axon terminus, we consider that the forward direction, because it kind of is the same, analogous to how an electrical impulse is transmitted from the cell body down to the axon terminus. The scientific way that we talk about the forward direction is that we call that anterograde. Anterograde transport is forward transport. And there needs to be a little motor protein that attaches to a microtubule, and we call that a kinesin molecule. But these materials can also flow in the reverse direction, and the scientific term for reverse direction is retrograde. So going retrograde is backwards, right? Compared to whatever we agree at the definition of forward is. And that requires a little bit different motor protein. That requires a dynein molecule. So the kinesins are for anterograde transport of these vesicles, and dynein molecules are necessary for retrograde. So which way would a vesicle go if it uses a dynein? Back to the cell body, which would be the same thing as retrograde. Okay, but you got to know the definition of retrograde. And as a matter of fact, some toxins and viruses actually find their way to the cell body via these processes, using these dynein and hop a ride on the monorail back into the cell body to cause that pathology. All right, so that would be nice to be able to figure out some. I don't know of any pharmaceuticals that can actually block this transport mechanism, but that might be really helpful at some point in time to block maybe a virus that's trying to find its way into the cell body. Okay. So you might actually have to think of these things later on. All right, so functional classification of neurons. Here we have a nice sensory neuron, right? So information goes from the periphery into the central nervous system via a unipolar neuron. And you can see that this neuron is partly in the peripheral nervous system, partly in the central nervous system. Here's a peripheral process, here's a central process. Here is a multipolar neuron, and you can see the cell body is in the spinal cord, and it goes all the way to some effector organ, at least if it's a somatic motor pathway. Oh, what does somatic mean? Somatic means voluntary. Somatic means somatic and voluntary mean the exact same thing. Here's another motor neuron, and we can see that its cell body is in the spinal cord, and its axon moves into the peripheral nervous system. But it doesn't go to effector organ. It goes to another multipolar neuron right here. And so this right here does not look like a somatic motor pathway. This looks like an autonomic motor pathway, right? Autonomic. So somatic is just one neuron. This is just kind of a review. So what kinds of effector organs are involved with the autonomic pathway? Can it be skeletal muscle?
No.
Nope. It's got to be cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or glands, right? Okay. All right. Now, there is another kind of neuron, which you guys might see on this slide. I'm not sure I do, but do you see a neuron in here anywhere? There is a neuron that's completely enclosed within the central nervous system, and those are neither afferent or efferent. Those are what we call interneurons or association neurons. So they integrate information, they make decisions on what to do for us, and so they're completely within the central nervous system. Okay, these others are what? Half in, half out, except for the postganglionic neuron of an autonomic pathway. Oh, it says somatic right there. Okay, well, that's handy for you guys. Okay. All right, so here are three basic types of neurons, and you should kind of know their functions, their names and functions. Here is a unipolar. You want to say pseudo-unipolar, that's fine with me, but I usually just say unipolar. This is what? What's the function of this kind of neuron? Yeah, you could say sensory or afferent. Here is a multipolar. It is typically efferent or motor. And this one right here is a real special one. There are fewer of these. This is the bipolar neuron. And these are found in organs of special senses. For instance, like the eyes and for vision, nose for olfaction, hearing in the ears. All right, just a few locations we find bipolar neurons. So these are a special form of sensory neuron. Okay, a special form of sensory neuron. Okay. So that's it for neurons. Let's turn our attention to support cells. And we're going to break our attention down into two anatomic structural areas, and that is peripheral nervous system versus central nervous system. Peripheral nervous system, we have two kinds of neuroglia cells. Now remember, neuroglia cells don't transmit electrical impulses, at least as far as anybody knows, right? But they provide other kinds of support functions that we're going to talk about. And in the peripheral nervous system, the two cells we have are Schwann cells and satellite cells. You see the Schwann cells here wrapping themselves around an axon. So here is a Schwann cell that's been cut open, and you can see a multitude of layers right here of a Schwann cell, and in each of these layers there is a lipid compound called myelin. Okay, and myelin, since it's a lipid, doesn't allow for electrical current to leak out or ions to leak out of the axon into the interstitial spaces right here. So the Schwann cells with this myelin sheath acts as insulation on this axon. It prevents the leak of current, electrical current, out of an axon. So this is very analogous to maybe wires that you have in your house. Okay, do the wires in your house have insulation? Like if you go to plug in an iron, if those wires didn't have insulation on them, would you plug your iron in or unplug it? No, because you could get electrocuted, right? So that insulation keeps the electricity inside this axon right here. That's the partly the job of this Schwann cell. And this area right here that contains the cytoplasm of the Schwann cell, this is what we call the neurilemma. The neurilemma. Okay, and here is the nucleus of the Schwann cell. But notice that there are numerous Schwann cells right here next to each other almost, but they're separated by this space. This is what we call a node of Ranvier, and that does not have any myelination at this region right here. So that does mean that these areas here and here can be sensitive to electrical events, right? And we'll see how what role that plays later on. These satellite cells we find around the nerve cell body of a unipolar neuron. So satellite cells are going to surround the cell body in the dorsal root ganglia. You can see their nuclei underneath a microscope, and it just kind of looks like a bunch of satellites circling a planet, so that's why we call those satellite cells. Okay, even though they don't move around, they just kind of look like it nonetheless. All right, so here you see a Schwann cell, how it wraps itself around and around and around and around an axon. And there's the myelin sheath with myelin, and then here is the neurilemma. And that electrically insulates the neuron. All right, so that's the peripheral nervous system. Here's the central nervous system. My guess is that this is an exam figure, right? You should know these by structure and what kind of function they're producing. All right, so the cells, let's just quickly go over the cells. We see ependymal cells, that's a kind of neuroglia. We see an astrocyte, that's a kind. Here is an oligodendrocyte, and then the last one is the microglia. All right, so let me just say something about microglia right here. Microglia are the immune systems, are the immune cells of the central nervous system. So they can crawl around between all your brain cells, and they're looking for foreign antigens, or for maybe even tumor cells that have lost their normal antigens. And when it bumps into a cell that doesn't have the right signature as belonging to your body, what is this microglia going to do? It's going to kill it. That's right. So maybe phagocytize it, lyse it, do something to it, and kill it. These oligodendrocytes, all right, now where are we? Peripheral or central nervous system? Central nervous system. Here is an oligodendrocyte, and you can see it wrapping around an axon, and it's going to synthesize myelin as well. And so oligodendrocytes are responsible for producing a myelin sheath in the central nervous system. But there's a big difference, because in the peripheral nervous system, a Schwann cell can only myelinate one little segment of an axon, but an oligodendrocyte can do what? Multiple segments of an axon, or what? Even multiple segments in multiple neurons. Right? So it's a little bit more complicated kind of cell, because it has many different, it has all these processes that are coming off of the cell body right here. All right? And its function is pretty much like a Schwann cell. It increases the speed of an impulse as it's moving down an axon. Okay? Many times, maybe 10 times. Maybe, well, probably even more than that. And clinically, these are important because every once in a while, somebody might develop an immune response to these oligodendrocytes that they have in their brain, and their own immune system kills these cells, unfortunately. And that disrupts the signal transmission down an axon. It disrupts the timing in somebody's brain, how different parts of the brain communicate with each other, and how muscles function, and disrupts the thinking processes and sensory processes of the individual, because these axons don't transmit impulses with the correct speed anymore. Does anybody know what that name of that disease process is? That's called, yeah, multiple sclerosis. Okay, multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease where these oligodendrocytes get destroyed by a person's own immune system. And of course, that can be very debilitating. There's some pretty good pharmaceuticals that are out there right now, maybe some lifestyle changes that can help protect somebody once they have multiple sclerosis, because one thing about multiple sclerosis is that it occurs and then it regresses and then it can reoccur. And so the job of therapy is to what? Is to lengthen that period of time when somebody is in remission and hopefully prevent a reoccurrence. Or if there is a reoccurrence, to decrease the severity of it. All right? So once you have multiple sclerosis, it can't be cured, but maybe to some degree it can be controlled for an individual. All right, so that's an oligodendrocyte. This last one right here, astrocyte, that's a pretty fascinating kind of neuroglia cell. You see, it has a number of processes like this oligodendrocyte, so you can probably see that they're related to each other, at least by the structure of them. However, you see one process that is attached to this capillary right here. What's the function of a capillary? For? Yeah, so exchange of nutrients or waste products or whatever. And the other process of an astrocyte connects up to a neuron. So it's a direct link between a blood supply in the brain and this neuron right here. So what does this neuron need to make ATP? For instance, yeah, it needs, well, like what kind of molecule? Glucose, right? So astrocytes actually can take up glucose from the circulatory system and deliver it directly to this neuron, right, to help maintain its respiration. All right, so that's one job of an astrocyte. I've got a slide that shows some other aspects of it, too. We'll get to another slide in a little bit. The last one right here are these ependymal cells. They line the ventricles. The ventricles contain cerebral spinal fluid. So this acts as a nice barrier between these neurons in your brain that are keeping you alive and maintaining your consciousness with the cerebral spinal fluid. Because maybe you can get an infection of the cerebral spinal fluid, you can get a chemical imbalance of the cerebral spinal fluid, and these ependymal cells right here will what? Help protect the neurons from those maladies. So that's just a protective barrier. There's also a protective barrier that develops between the circulatory system and the nerves of your central nervous system. We call that the blood-brain barrier. And that is helped, maintained, and produced by astrocytes. And again, whenever you eat something, and they could be toxic compounds or they could be helpful compounds, they all end up in the blood. And if there was not a blood-brain barrier, all the little toxins that we happen to consume would have free access to these neurons, and it might be fatal, right? So the blood-brain barrier protects you from noxious chemicals that you have in the circulatory system. Sometimes that's an unnecessary difficulty. It's something that's unwanted because you might actually take a drug. Maybe you could take a drug for multiple sclerosis. But if it's not designed correctly, it can't get through the blood-brain barrier and work its effects inside the brain. So when you're designing pharmaceuticals for the brain, you always have to keep in the back of the mind how you're going to do what? How you're going to get across the blood-brain barrier to actually get it in the brain. So there are different manipulations that you have to do. Okay, so here you see oligodendrocyte. You're immediately going to think, what? Central nervous system. Speeds the rate of an impulse conduction down an axon. Okay. That's a little bit out of order. I probably wanted to copy that into something else. Oh, no, I know what we're talking about. All right. We're going to talk a little bit about nerve regeneration, just for a couple slides. And you probably know that when you damage an axon in the central nervous system, like a spinal cord injury, what happens? Does that paralysis go away? Do those nerves regenerate? No, they can't. Okay. So axonal regeneration occurs more readily in the peripheral nervous system than in the central nervous system, and it has to do with the oligodendrocytes and the Schwann cells, right? The neuroglia cells that are those two different places. So oligodendrocytes produce proteins that inhibit regrowth because the oligodendrocytes produce a scar. It blocks over the little tube that an axon would actually grow through. Right? So it actually produces a scar that blocks regrowth. But in the peripheral nervous system, these are Schwann cells. When an axon is damaged, right, these Schwann cells regroup, right, and they grow, and they secrete factors, which then stimulates the regrowth of an axon through what we call the regeneration tube formed by the Schwann cells to this effector organ right here. And so this effector organ can be reinnervated by this healthy nerve cell body that just had its axon severed. All right, so this happens in the peripheral nervous system but does not happen in the central nervous system because of those oligodendrocytes. Okay. There are some neuroglia cells. Well, I tell you what, going back to regeneration in the central nervous system, this is kind of a new concept. We know that the central nervous system doesn't regenerate, and for a long time we thought that the brain, number of cells in the brain never gets bigger, right? You can lose brain cells, but you can never regenerate brain cells, right? Because we just never saw that process happening. But more recently, we know that that's really not the case, right? That you can regenerate brain cells. Okay, so there are stem cells in the brain. Yeah, so that's really a good thing, right? And there's other things that can actually help the brain function, even though you maybe don't increase the number of brain cells, right? And these are due to compounds that we call neurotrophins. So neurotrophins are chemicals that are secreted primarily by astrocytes. All right, so astrocytes secrete neurotrophins, and they promote fetal nerve growth during development. And everybody knew that the nervous system of newborns has to grow, right? But it's also important for the survival of many adult neurons. In order for them not to atrophy, they need to receive neurotrophins from astrocytes in particular. And even now we know that these same neurotrophins can even be used for regeneration of nerve tissue. All right, and some of these neurotrophins would be called brain-derived neurotrophic factor from an astrocyte. All right, so what does that mean for us? So here's that astrocyte, and it might secrete a neurotrophin, and it might not actually increase the number of brain cells that you have, but a neurotrophin can increase the number of connections that you have between nerve cells. Okay, and so if you increase the number of connections between nerve cells, then the information can be shared and can be integrated and can be used by an individual more effectively. So it's a learning process. When neurons make more connections, our brains actually get smarter. Right? And as a matter of fact, we can understand learning as just a process of what? Making new connections between existing cells with these synapses between them. And that's the job, one of the jobs of this astrocyte right here. Let me see what the next slide is. Oh yeah, blood-brain barrier, talked about that. Next slide. All right, let me talk some more about astrocyte. All right, so probably in anatomy, you learned, what about your bones? What can you tell me about a bone? Is it like a dead tissue? Is it like that column standing right there in this building? What's happening? It's a living tissue, right? It's remodeling itself all the time. There's living cells in there. You got a balance between osteoclasts and osteoblasts. What does an osteoclast do again? It breaks down bone. That's right, because how often do you get a new skeleton? Okay, every 5 years you have a new skeleton because your bone is broken down, it's rebuilt. It's rebuilt in ways that make sense for whatever activities you're doing. Okay, so that's bone. What about muscle? Like if I have this biceps right here, if I start exercising this biceps all the time, what's going to happen to it? Is it going to be the same biceps in 2 weeks? No, I won't even be able to put it in this shirt, right? Because it's going to get big, right? It's going to hypertrophy. It's going to respond to that stress by growing, okay? Same thing with bone, right? You stress the bone, you exercise the bone, it's going to get bigger and stronger. And that's the basis of how people protect themselves from what disease process? Osteoporosis, right? You have to stress the bone, make it big and strong, and that prevents you from experiencing pathological bone loss as we get older. And that will happen to everybody, but especially women with what? Very thin bones, because they can't afford to lose a lot of calcium as they get older. But everybody will experience osteoporosis to some degree. So living tissues have the ability to what? Respond and adapt and change to their environment. And actually, the brain does a marvelous job at that too. And the thing that brains like to do more than anything else is to actually learn things. Okay, it might not seem like it the night before a test, but the brain is designed completely to experience its environment and learn something about the environment. And that can be good and that can be bad. That learning process is involved with these neurotrophins. All right, so just like a muscle, when you use it, what happens to it? It changes shape, which then changes the function. When you exercise a bone, it does what? It changes shape, that changes the function of a bone. When you use your brain, guess what happens? Its structure changes, right? And that's one way that we can understand learning. Okay, and its structure changes because of these neurotrophins that are secreted by astrocytes. So more connections are made. And we even know that maybe even some nerve cells can be regenerated. You might have more nerve cells in certain parts of the brain when you do what to your brain? When you stress it, when you present it with new information. Okay? And that has some important ramifications, since the brain really likes to learn things and how we treat some kinds of patients. The brain will learn anything that it experiences. And one bad part of that is when somebody has an epileptic seizure. Okay, that means that there is unfortunate electrical activity that develops in the brain and it causes motor activity all over the body. Guess what the brain does after you experience an epileptic seizure? Okay, it actually learns how to produce that seizure much more easily the second time around. All right, and then what about after the second time? It's even easier the third time. And then what about the fourth time? It's even easier the fourth time to produce these seizures. So when we start to treat patients with epilepsy, would we like to treat it very aggressively the very first time, or do we like to just kind of watch back and see what might happen? No aggressive treatment, because what does the brain like to do? It just likes to learn things, right? The brain really doesn't know that an epileptic seizure is not a good thing or a bad thing for the organism, right? It just knows that it's learning something. All right, so that's one example. Another example is that people with clinical depression, we now know that there is a part of the brain that atrophies. It's the hippocampus, and the hippocampus is responsible for releasing a lot of neurotrophins. And what we understand about one aspect of clinical depression is that people have a hard time learning new things because they're overstressed, maybe with too much stimuli. And with antidepressant therapy, we see that the hippocampus can come back, the levels of neurotrophins increase, and a person's depression is alleviated. Okay? The other thing is that we also know that with depression, it is episodic in nature too. People can get depressed and then feel well again and then get depressed, and it's just like epilepsy. The first occurrence might be precipitated by some kind of tragic event in somebody's life, which produces a depression. All right? But what does the brain know after that first episode of depression? It knows how to produce that depressed state in somebody's mind. So what about the second episode? It requires a lower stimulus to produce that same episode. What about the third time? Even a lower stimulus, right? So that the brain learns how to produce that depressed state. So again, how would you treat somebody with clinical depression? Would you kind of be very conservative and look and see what happens, or do what? Treat it aggressively, right? So that the brain doesn't know how to produce that state again. Right, so if somebody has a lot of depressive episodes, unfortunately, in their life, guess what might happen the night before a physiology exam? Yeah, they might get depressed, right? Because that might be enough of a stimulus to produce that kind of disease, right? And so those astrocytes are real important. We know now to work with astrocytes, right, to help defeat depression. And actually, we actually see that the hippocampus actually grows back normally with antidepressant therapy. So the other thing is that when you're taking a really hard class, like what's a really hard class? Like microbiology maybe? Physiology is a hard class? Okay, well, in order for you to learn things, what has to happen to your brain? Okay, it's got to change its shape. Okay, in order for you to learn things, because it actually is pretty complicated stuff. I was just kidding you when I wasn't saying physiology isn't that hard. It's a pretty strenuous kind of course of study. And what does your brain actually have to do? It's got to make new connections between cells. It's got to be responsive. It's got to respond to brain-derived neurotrophic factor. New synapses have to form. Maybe even you get some new brain cells up there. So the shape, the structure of your brain has to change. That can't happen overnight. That's something I don't like so much about really short classes in the summertime or something, because you don't have enough time to rearrange your brain. But in this kind of class, your brain has to rearrange itself. And I'm just always really amazed, and I actually like to thank you guys for trusting me enough to rearrange and remodel your brain this semester. Okay, because it's happening. And that's a lot of times that at the end of the class, even though the material is harder, how does it appear? It appears easier because by that time your brain has restructured itself to learn that kind of material, right? So astrocytes are real important. Other things that astrocytes do is that it helps regulate potassium levels, right, in the interstitial space. It recycles neurotransmitters. So, and we haven't talked about this yet, but here is an axon terminus, and here we see vesicles filled with neurotransmitter. These will be released when an electrical impulse gets down to the axon terminus. Neurotransmitter then can stimulate another electrical event in the postsynaptic cell. So you're familiar with the presynaptic versus postsynaptic cell from anatomy. And this neurotransmitter has to be dealt with when it's in the synaptic cleft. Otherwise, it will continuously forever stimulate the postsynaptic cell, but it should have a short duration. One way that it has a short duration is that it is taken up by this astrocyte and removed from the synaptic cleft so that another impulse can then properly stimulate the postsynaptic cell. So that's another job of this astrocyte. Recycling of neurotransmitter. Regulating adult neurogenesis. Oh, that's what I just talked about for the last 10 minutes. I hope not more than that, but maybe I got carried away. All right, but that's really exciting to know how your brain is changing, right? So I guess another corollary to that is you got to be careful what you experience, you know, what you stick in your brain. Stick good things in your brain, because then your brain, what, changes shape in good ways. Okay, releases neurotransmitters that regulate neuroactivity. We're just beginning to understand something about that. Maybe I'll talk about that later in the class. All right, and then, of course, astrocytes are important for forming that blood-brain barrier. Okay, membrane potential. All right, so now this course gets fun. Okay, this chapter gets fun. Membrane potential, but You learned something about a membrane potential already. What does potential mean? It means voltage, okay? And if there's a voltage, that means that there's a separation in charge. There's some area that has a high concentration of some kind of electrical charge, maybe positive, and in some other location, there's going to be more negatives or not as many positives, right? So there's a difference in electrical charge between two different places. And the place where there is a difference in electrical charge is the cell membrane, right? So there is a voltage difference between the cell membrane right here. All right, we talked about RMP. At rest, cells have a negative internal charge. Is that ringing a bell?
Yeah,
all right. Compared to the outside at rest when the cell isn't doing anything. And of course, what is that's the result of what? Large, probably you should put like an A right here and an N right there, right? There are anions inside the cell that make the inside of the cell negative, right? Not cations. And they're trapped, they're too big to leave through the plasma membrane. What else? The sodium potassium pump helps maintain the resting membrane potential. I guess that's all I'm going to say about that slide. Okay. Neurons are excitable. All right, because there is a membrane potential across the membrane, these ions would like to diffuse down their electrochemical gradient. So if we give them a way to diffuse, right, they're going to move just passively by diffusion. Right? And these changes can be very rapid by changing the permeability to ions. Now, what could you tell me about an ion? Can it get through the cell membrane by itself?
No.
And why is that?
It's charged.
It's charged, which means it is a charged particle is hydrophilic, and the membrane inside is hydrophobic. Okay, and so ions can't just normally cross the plasma membrane by themselves. In order to get there, they have to go through something we call a channel, right? There's got to be a channel, which is a membrane protein. Okay, all right, and so neurons and muscles have something very in common. They are excitable because they can change the permeability of various ions across the membrane, and when they do that, they can generate and conduct electrical impulses. Maybe one way to kind of think of that is when you have an ion, which is a charge in motion is really an electrical current. So when sodium goes from outside the cell to the inside, that's actually what? An electrical current, even though it's just a molecule that is moving. All right, so how can we look at some of these visualize? Here's a graph of visualizing what voltage is. In order to measure voltage, we could use a meter and just look at the voltage, but sometimes we would like to see how voltage changes over time, and we would use an instrument right here that is an oscilloscope. Okay, so here's an oscilloscope. On the vertical axis, we're going to measure voltage, and the horizontal axis right here is just a time axis. So it's just a plot of voltage versus time. All right, so if you have a battery, how many terminals does a battery have? It's got two. If your car battery was dead, you need two wires, right, to get it started. And maybe you have, like the batteries I use for my recorder right here, it's got two terminals on it. So every battery's got two terminals. So in order to measure voltage, you need two electrodes, one on each terminal, to measure what that voltage is. So here is an oscilloscope, and how many electrodes does it have? I see two. One stays outside the cell, and the other you have to poke inside the cell to measure the difference across the plasma membrane. So what's the size of these electrodes right here? They've got to be really small, right? They've got to be microscopic. You couldn't like put a baseball bat inside that cell right there. And actually, do you think it's really hard or easy to make these tiny electrodes? Okay. All right, you know what? It's really easy. I've made hundreds of these little electrodes. And to tell you how to make it, you just take some glass tubing, and if you put glass tubing in a Bunsen burner, what happens to it? It heats up, and it starts to melt. It kind of looks, not quite drips off. Probably if you heat it hard enough or high enough, it will actually drip off. But it just gets really loose, almost like a liquid. And if you make it really soft and pull it, okay, guess what happens? It gets really, 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 really thin, and then if you pull it enough, then it just snaps. And where it snaps, you have a little microscopic tube all the way through right there. And then if you fill that tube with salt, But it's salt, sodium and chloride, they're ions that can carry electrical activity. So now you have this little microscopic glass tube that actually can act like a wire, and that's an electrode. So that's how you would make these little electrodes. Just heat up a piece of glass tubing and snap it really quick, and it forms like a little micro pipette. But then you have to be really careful with it because, why? Because you can't see the tip because it's microscopic. And if you poke yourself in the eye or finger or something, then you got that glass, because glass really never goes away. So you got to be careful with them. So you use a nice microscope and you stick it inside the cell, and now you have an electrode inside the cell and some kind of electrode outside, and you can measure the voltage across the membrane, which will be displayed on this oscilloscope right here. All right, so under resting conditions, what is a typical kind of resting membrane voltage or resting membrane potential? It's about minus 70 right here, okay? And we said that neurons are excitable. We can open or close ion channels, and we can change the voltage, or it itself can change the voltage across the membrane. So if we put positive charge inside the cell, what's going to happen to the voltage inside the cell? Okay, but is it going to become more negative or less negative? It's going to be less negative. So, okay, here is resting membrane potential, minus 70. If we put positive charges inside the cell, it's going to get less negative. It's going to go toward zero right here. So when it moves from R and P towards zero, that's what we call depolarization. That's depolarization. And that is stimulatory. That can't excite a cell. All right. If for whatever reason we put negative charges inside, what's going to happen to R and P? It's going to move farther away from zero, and that's what we call hyperpolarization. If it goes below the RMP, that's hyperpolarization. There's one other term, and that is, if we put positive charges inside the cell, what does that produce again? If we put positive charges in, that is depolarization. So we depolarize the cell. So now maybe we're up, let's go to zero. We've depolarized it to zero. All right, now we put negative charges back in, what's going to happen? Okay. Going from zero to RMP right here, we don't call that hyperpolarization, we just call that repolarization. All right, so you got these three processes. You got depolarization, when RMP moves towards zero, and it actually might even go positive, that's depolarization. Repolarization is bringing it back down to RMP, and it can even overshoot a little bit, and that's what we would call hyperpolarization. Okay? And we need this nice oscilloscope right here to see those kinds of things. Okay. All right, so what causes these things? Well, there have to be ion channels that allow charged particles to move one way or another. And we're going to become familiar with two general kinds of membrane channels. One kind is what we call a voltage-gated channel. It's going to open and close depending on the voltage across the membrane. All right. Some channels may be normally open, some might be normally closed. We'll have to look at these in an individual circumstance. Closed channels, right, or some channels have molecular gates, right, that can be opened depending on the voltage. So voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in resting cells, and so are voltage-gated sodium channels. Right? They're closed in resting cells at all. So when a cell is at rest, neither this potassium or sodium can move. Right? But let's just say if it was a sodium channel that opened, which way would sodium move? Would sodium move one way or the other?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, why would sodium move in if all of a sudden we opened up a channel? Because sodium is high on the outside, it's low on the inside, it will diffuse down its concentration gradient. That's one reason. There's another reason. The second reason is the electrical charge attraction. Because what kind of charges attract each other?
Opposite
charges, right? So in the resting case, the inside is negative and sodium is positive, it's on the outside. It will be attracted to the inside of the cell because of the electrochemical gradient. Both are forcing sodium to go inside the cell. Okay. So here is a representation of a membrane protein that can act as an ion channel. And it has a number of different components to it. And this one right here, let's just say maybe this is a sodium channel. Sodium channel is normally closed. You see it closed right here? Okay. And we can open it up. We can open it up in two different ways. We can have it maybe bind a molecule, in which case it would be a ligand-gated channel. Maybe when it binds a neurotransmitter like acetylcholine, it's going to cause this channel to open. And when it's open, guess what sodium can do? It can enter the cell. And when it enters the cell, what happens to the voltage inside the cell?
It gets depolarized.
It becomes less negative because sodium is a positive ion. All right. But maybe it's not a ligand-gated channel. Maybe it is a voltage-gated channel. So it's going to stay closed until the cell becomes depolarized, and when the voltage changes, then it opens up and it lets sodium enter the cell, which then makes the voltage change even more, even faster as a result of that. Okay, so these channels can either be ligand-gated or voltage-gated, but there's something else here too. And that happens, we describe it with this little ball and chain. Even though the channel is open, this little extra protein right here can be placed in the opening of the channel. And when this protein is placed in the opening of the channel, what happens to the patency of this channel? Even though it's expanded, it's open, can sodium flow through it? Nope, it gets blocked. So this is what we call an inactivation gate. Inactivation gate. And even though the channel is open, if the inactivation gate is in this position, the channel is really closed. Okay, the channel is closed. And it's not going to allow for movement of, say, sodium from the outside to the inside of the cell as a result. So we got two mechanisms. The inactivation gate and the channel itself is going to be controlled by a signaling molecule or maybe a voltage. Okay. It's a molecular gate. And I'm not sure anybody knows what it looks like, but that's just an illustration of what it might look like. Inactivation gate. It can close, right? It can close this channel in just an instant, just by slamming closed. Okay. Yep. Okay. All right, so what we're going to start talking about next time is something called an action potential. Okay? An action potential. So what does potential mean again? Before you go, voltage, and action means what? What's happening to that voltage? It's changing. So instead of just being constant like at RMP, that voltage is going to go up or go down or do something different. That's an action potential. All right? And action potentials are due to this kind of membrane protein, namely a voltage-gated channel. Voltage-gated channels produce action potentials. Okay? All right, so now don't forget, we're going to have to go over this material a number of times before you get an idea of what's happening. So if you want to read ahead, that would be great. That would help lecture a little bit. But no test next time. And the sign-in sheet is right here if you need the sign-in sheet. If you know somebody that's not signing in, you got to tell them they're going to get dropped.